Among those just mentioned by Betty in her historical recount of the Kentucky Derby is a jockey named Jimmy Wingfield. He won the big race 2 years in a row, 1901 and 1902. Jimmy Wingfield's success in the sport and his tragic fall is as much a story about race as horse racing. New York Times reporter Joe Drape has written a new book about the jockey called Black Maestro. NPR's Farai Chidea asked the author about uncovering this little-known piece of racing history.
Over time, our country seems to discover all of these hidden histories, and this is one of the most dramatic ones I've heard of. How does Jimmy Wingfield figure in America's untold stories?
He came of age right when Jim Crow laws were coming down. There was a backlash to Reconstruction. In New York, Irish immigrants were pouring in, and their fathers were selling them to racetrack guys. So he kind of got squeezed in that vice right there. And he was the last African-American to win it, and he was only one of four of any color to win it back-to-back. But truly, that's the least remarkable thing about him. I mean, his ventures in Russia and France are just extraordinary.
Describe the 20th century that Wingfield came of age in. Tell us how his personality interacted with the events of the time.
Well, he grew up down in the bluegrass here, and he was the last of 17 children. The slaves had traditionally taken care of these expensive thoroughbreds. When they were emancipated, they stayed with them. But it was a brutal and vicious environment they lived in. There were hangings, over 300 in the state, during the times he was growing up. And he really knew how to keep his place, and his place was learning to be a very gifted horseman. There's an old saying that the only two places men were equal was above the turf, which meant the track, and below it when they were dead.
Now, when he happened to encounter racism head-on, like the Ku Klux Klan, what saved him?
You know, he had an incredible dignity and an incredible endurance, and he always stood his ground. And truly, he was so gifted with horses that he was valued a little bit more, but he also learned not to expect anything more.
When did he finally leave the United States, and under what circumstances?
In 1904, and it was basically he was out of work. At this point, the white jockeys were taking over the tracks, and they were having fistfights at 35 miles an hour against the African Americans. The white owners, they liked having the African American riders. They were the most skilled, but their horses were getting beat up in the process of this. So finally, he couldn't get any rides, or mounts, as we call them. And he saw an ad in a newspaper from a man named Jack Keane. And Keane had been in Russia, and he was looking for somebody to replace him.
What happened next?
Well, you know, he goes over there with nothing but a Russian, Polish, English dictionary. He meets a man named Michael Lazarev, who is one of the richest men in the world. He's an Armenian. He controls the Baku oil fields. And he's also a very dedicated horseman. And he's trying to build a breeding operation that rivals those in England and France. So there he becomes sort of the Michael Jordan of pre- and post-revolution Russia. He's not only covered in the sports pages, where he's the black maestro, but he's in the gossip pages, too. He's living at the National Hotel, making hundreds of thousands of dollars. He has a white valet. He marries the first of two white Russian women, both of nobility. That's where he basically became Russian in his soul. When the World War I breaks out, he slides down to Austria, waits it out. But, you know, the World War I finishes up, and the revolution gathers steam. So he goes with the nobility up to Odessa on the Baltic Sea. You know, in 1919, cannons are being fired on the track. He and this band of, you know, ragtag noblemen who just basically had been hiding out up there have to take 260 thoroughbreds, women and children, and get them to safety. Women and children were the first priority, but those thoroughbreds were the bloodline to a tradition that they'd worked very hard to create, so they were very important. And he embarks with these guys on this epic, harrowing journey, 1,100 miles, 3 months, Bolsheviks firing on him, no food, villagers robbing him. And they finally get to Warsaw, both man and horse is emaciated. They stay there, and they build this breed up. And if you go look on Bloodlines right now, those same horses he saved are some of the greatest stallions in Europe.
That is truly an amazing story. But this man also, during the course of the Revolution and World War II, suffered some personal losses. Tell us about that.
Well, when he went to Odessa, he had to leave behind his wife, Alexandra, and his son, George. You know, he was a little vain. He didn't want to quit competing. He had several infidelities. But these were his true loves, and he left and didn't look behind. After he gets to Warsaw, another one of his patrons, a man named Manischew, sends for him to France, says, I got all my horses out. Come ride for me. So he goes there, and he basically doesn't see his wife and child for 5 years. He honestly believed that they had died in the revolution. They show up. Alexander was a fragile, emotional soul anyway, and she had a touch of madness or imbalance at that point. And so, you know, he had to put her in an institution. George was 10 when they left. He tries to reconnect to his father, and he naturally wants to learn how to ride horses. And so Jimmy teaches him, and he becomes a pretty decent rider, but he gets big. He kind of ran wild and fell into a wrong crowd, and he eventually died at the age of 26.
Jimmy went on to have yet more acts in his life. Tell us about where he was when he died and how old he was.
He was 91, and it was 1974 in Maisons-Laffitte, and that was where they settled after they left Russia. But in 48, the war breaks out. The Nazis come and basically requisition all his horses, his stables, and his house. And he and his second wife at the time, Lydia, and another son, Robert, are forced back to Depression-era America with $9 to their pocket. He and Robert, who was very gifted with horses, end up down in South Carolina breaking two-year-olds or baby horses and living in a stall together with a hot plate for $8 a month. Some of the old-timers down south recognized him and said, you know, didn't you win a Derby? And he's like, yes, I won two of them. So they started to give him a few thoroughbreds to train. And the most remarkable thing is he and Robert took some old broken-down horses, and they go to what I call the hard toast and grit circuit, West Virginia, Maryland, Delaware, cheap little tracks where they're the only black men in sight. And you see these dusty old photos of him in the winner's circle, and he's got his fedora on, his dapper double-breasted suit. He loved that life. It reminded him of when he was growing up, and eventually he earned enough money to go back to Maison. But in 1961, Sports Illustrated discovered him, wrote a nice article about him, then invited him down to that Kentucky Derby here in Louisville, and they have a dinner, and they won't let him walk through the front door of the Brown Hotel. Jimmy stood his ground there. He just kept sending the guy back. Tell him I'm here. Tell him I'm here. After three or four times, they got tired of, you know, telling him no, and they let him come in. And he shows up in this sea of white faces. The only guy who says hello is Roscoe Goose, another Lexington boy, a white guy who grew up with Jimmy when there was a camaraderie around the racetrack.
The Kentucky Derby has for years seen jockeys from Latin America and other places, and few African Americans are entering the sport. Is there any move to get black jockeys back into the sport? I have to say, I think of the lawn jockey.
You know, unfortunately not. And again, history's conspired on that. There's a handful of African American jockeys out there from Louisiana to West Virginia to Ohio. Interestingly enough, there's two people of color racing in this Saturday's race, and one is Sean Bridge Mohan, who's from Jamaica, and the other is Patrick Husbands, who's from Barbados. They're going to be an anomaly from here on out.
Thank you, Joe.
Thank you.
New York Times reporter Joe Drape's latest book is titled Black Maestro, The Extraordinary Life of Jimmy Wakefield. You enjoy the Derby now.
I hope I pick a winner.
That was NPR's Farai Chidea.